Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, listeners. This is NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project. Today is March 28, 2013, and I'm your host, Tanya Baker, at the NWP in Berkeley, California. Tonight we're talking with Robin Holland, co-director of the Columbus Area Writing Project and author of Deeper Writing, Quick Writes and Mentor Texts to Illuminate New Possibilities, as well as the blog Deeper Writing and Reading of the World. Lynn Dorfman, who's the co-director of the Pennsylvania Writing and Literature Project, author with Rose Capelli of Mentor Texts, Nonfiction Mentor Texts, and Poetry Mentor Texts. Carla Trutman, a teacher consultant of the Northern California Writing Project and an AP American History and American Literature teacher in Yreka, California. Thank you all for joining us tonight.
Great to be here.
Thank you. We're pleased to be here.
It's very exciting to be part of this. Thank you.
Tonight, we are going to open up a large conversation on the topic of mentor texts as tools and inspiration for writing of all kinds. This is a particularly timely moment for this discussion as educators across the country are increasingly turning their attention to preparing young people for success in college and careers with a focus on relevant and rigorous reading and writing. As always, if you are listening to us live, we invite you to join us in the chat room where we will be posting links to materials related to tonight's program. Since we have such a packed show tonight, I'd really like to jump right in, and I'd like to first welcome Lynn. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. As the first guest on tonight's show, I was hoping that you would give us a definition of mentor texts to set the stage for the discussion. What are mentor texts?
Yes, mentor texts are pieces of literature that you, both teacher and student, can return to and reread for many different purposes. They are texts to be studied and imitated. At first attempt, the student may imitate the text very closely, but as the student continues to try out the strategy or the organizational format, sentence structure, punctuation, whatever the student is studying, eventually that student reaches a comfortable spot and can make that strategy or practice his own. It becomes a fingerprint for the individual writer. Mentor texts help students to take risks and be different writers tomorrow than they are today. It helps them to try out new strategies and formats. They should be basically books that students can relate to and can even read independently or with some support. And, of course, a mentor text doesn't have to be in the form of a book. A mentor text might be a poem, a newspaper article, song lyrics, comic strips, manuals, essays, almost anything.
So I love that, Lynn. It seems like there are these sort of big key ideas. There are texts you return to again and again. You use them to learn one or and many things about writing, and that students' use of mentor texts help them to outgrow themselves, let them try on new ideas or strategies.
Yes. That's right.
That's great. That definition will serve as a touchstone for us throughout the hour, I think, and maybe it's even a mentor text. We'll have to see if we come back to it and write some more definitions. Let's talk specifically, Lynn, about your work. Can you give us a little background about yourself as a teacher, a reader, a writer, and your connection to mentor texts?
Yes. I'm actually very proud that my career has spanned 38 years, all within the same district, Upper Moreland School District. I became a writing coach through a grant, and I taught grades K through 5. It was my dream job. I was a teacher of writers all day long, and that included the staff, students and teachers alike. I did other things, too. I've taught gifted education program. I acted as a literacy coach and the literacy framework leader. I was part of a mentor cadre, K through 12. And I ended my career as a reading specialist / literacy coach. My favorite part was really going out into the classroom and modeling and co-planning and observing other teachers teaching young writers. I've always loved writing, though. When I first came to the writing project, it was through a love of writing. I used to actually compose songs to play on my folk guitar, and I wrote poetry and stories throughout my school years.
Lynn, that's a great picture of your career, of yourself and of your career, and it's what a beautiful gift to the Moreland's Upper Moreland School District. Lucky them. Can you tell us about getting involved with the Pennsylvania Writing and Literature Project?
Oh, yes. I attended the Pennsylvania Writing and Literature Project in 1989. I went to their Summer Invitational Institute on the Teaching of Writing. And POP changed my life as a teacher. The Writing Project brought so many new ideas to the front burner. And when I went back to school, I just had to keep thinking, okay, one thing at a time, because I learned so much. And I started actually having a true writer's workshop. Really, I learned how to be so much more effective with conferences. I started a portfolio assessment system. Even my reading program changed, and I began to conduct literature circles. One thing that the Writing Project did for me, I became a teacher consultant, and I started to actually teach and co-teach courses for the Writing Project. And that's actually how I first met my co-author, Rose Capelli, who works for the Westchester Area School District. And it was here in that course, Writing in Children's Literature, that the idea of mentor text arose. We taught this course for 10 consecutive years for the Writing Project. And it was one of the best things I ever could have done. Plus, the other thing I learned from the Writing Project was that I had a lot of reading to do. I started becoming a reader of professional books, and I just couldn't believe that I had tried to teach for 13 years without really doing this. The Writing Project showed me all that I had missed, and oh, my goodness, I have so many favorite authors like Reggie Routman and Katie Wood Ray, Ralph Fletcher, Jeff Anderson, Mark Overmyer, Georgia Hurd, Kelly Gallagher, Barry Lane, and, of course, the bigger-than-life literacy giant who we all miss dearly, Don Graves. But I also started reading professional books on the teaching of reading, books by Lucy Calkins, Linda Hoyt, Chris Tavani, Dick Allington. And then I actually had the pleasure of working in the summer program, in the Young Readers and Writers program, through the Writing Project. And I really hope to return to do that again. It was just such a rewarding experience. The other thing, I got to teach a wonderful course called Teacher as Writer. And, oh, my goodness, that was so wonderful. It spurred me on to continue to keep my own writer's notebook and try to write it in it daily. And I still do that because a teacher of writers really needs to be a teacher who writes. Writing isn't a spectator sport. You have to really just jump in and play the game.
Well said. Wow, I love to hear you talk about your Writing Project experience. It's so many things echo my own Writing Project experience, and just the excitement and enthusiasm that you bring to talking about all these opportunities and all this excitement. And
can I just say, too, that the Writing Projects across the country offer an opportunity to form friendships that will last a lifetime? And one thing that I really love about Writing Project people, you can be a kindergarten teacher and your best buddy can be a teacher who teaches 11th and 12th graders. You really span the grade levels with Writing Project people, and it's just, you feel like you're home.
You know, Lynn, thank you. Yes, of course you can say that, and I have to say that I say that all the time as well, that it does feel like home, like a professional home and a collegial and a personal home. So, yes, thanks for saying so. I agree. I know there are many people listening tonight's show because they are fans of your books, mentor texts, nonfiction mentor texts, and poetry mentor texts. Can you tell us a little about how you got started with your first book?
Yes. As I said before, I partnered with Rose Capelli. I met Rose through the Writing Project, And we decided that we would try to teach writing and children's literature together. And we just couldn't come up with a book that really fit what we were doing after about 4 or 5 years in. We just couldn't find a textbook that really matched what we were doing in the course. And everyone kept saying to us, well, why don't you write one? That went on and on for several years. And then finally, we met our publisher through Reading Matters and Patty Solenberger, who is a Stenhouse distributor in our area. And we met Bill Varner, who is the best. And
best, isn't he?
Yes, and he believed in us, and he took a chance. He knew just what advice we needed and when to give it. Some important advice he gave us was, I will never forget him saying, ladies, let me do my job. I'm the editor. You write down your ideas and stop trying to edit yourselves and decide what should be in the book and what shouldn't. I'll decide that. And that was very freeing for the two of us. That was really freeing. He said, you know, I'm not the idea person. You are. So you two write your ideas down and let me do my job. And he was just great. Before we wrote our first book, though, we tried to read as many Stenhouse authors as we could, especially authors that were author pairs, like Stephanie Harvey and Ann Goodvis, because we wanted to see how they were able to sculpt a book that sounded like it was written in one voice. Frankie and Karen do that, too. And, of course, we had to read Debbie Miller, and so that helped us a lot. And then we started to follow the Stenhouse blog. And right now we are still following the blog and sometimes submitting posts for the blog, such as Poetry Month. We're blogging for Poetry Month, and we also started our own website. So it was just a great experience, but I think the one thing you have to do when you write a book is, in some ways you do have to treat it like a job. You have to have a routine. You have to have a schedule. Rose was great with that. She kept an agenda. She had a little book with a list, and she said, this is what we're going to try to accomplish today. And we wrote probably at least once a week together, and then several weeks in the summer, and then on our own. And, of course, now Google Docs and such is a wonderful thing because you can share files next to one another to do that.
Yeah. That's so exciting. Thanks.
It is. It's very exciting. It's hard work, but it's worth it. I think it's worth it. The greatest thing is that I can imagine that there's a teacher out there that I will never meet, but I'm hoping that she is liking writing or maybe even loving it right now, loving to teach writing because she has our books, and they've helped her out. And that's all we really wanted to do, was to be able to help teachers and kids.
Well, you know, from my job where I get to meet teachers from around the network, I know that that's true because people talk to us about your books when they come out. They're so excited. So,
oh, that's great.
Yeah. Lynn, we opened this segment by asking you to define the idea of mentor text. Now that we've heard a little bit about you as a teacher and a writer and a reader, I want to get back to talking about your theory of action behind the use of mentor text in the classroom. So can you talk to us about that?
Yes. Rose and I particularly love to use picture books as mentor text. And the reason why we like them, especially at the elementary school level, is because picture books provide the models that will help elementary school students grow as writers. First of all, they're doable. A student can't sit down during writing workshop and say, I'm going to write the Harry Potter novel. But a student can look at a picture book and say, I can do that. And I remember Shelley Harwain said once, it's all about looking at something and saying, I can do that, and believing it. Picture books stimulate creativity and create interest because they have beautiful illustrations, paintings that add another layer to the text. And, of course, they're really attractive for our most struggling readers and non-readers, students who just choose not to read. And also for our struggling writers, because it really it gives them a chance to say, wow, I could add drawings to my text if I want to. Picture books contain so many life lessons. They're a roller coaster of emotions. They have wonderful words, perfect words in perfect places. They're culturally diverse and represent so many different genres and subgenres. They demonstrate the importance of choosing words wisely. Words carry our ideas, and so a writer has to choose very carefully. And a picture book author only has 28 to 32 pages to say it all. So I think a picture book author is a great one to imitate. The other thing is, for a teacher, our enemy is time. You know, we always say we don't have enough time. But picture books are short enough to be shared entirely in one reading. So it's easier for teachers to find time for them in their busy schedules, and also for students to revisit these mentor texts and use them independently. I think the other thing I would ask teachers to think about is to try to find their favorite 15 to 25 books representing nonfiction, fiction, and poetry for the entire year. And even though your classroom library could have hundreds of books in it, you have these 15 to 25 mentor texts. And you're going to revisit them throughout the entire year. So you're not going to teach one book at a time. You're going to introduce that mentor text through a read aloud and then return to it the next day or two to teach a strategy, such as maybe writing effective leads. That same mentor text could be revisited throughout the year to teach concepts such as creating a satisfying ending, how do I use effective repetition in my text, how do I use adjectives out of order, or I could study a punctuation mark like the colon or an ellipsis. How to build content with rich description or use of anecdote, using a seesaw structure, and so much more. So a mentor text really is a text that becomes a familiar friend. Students feel comfortable with it, and they can own the strategies that the author uses. They can be successful. But a mentor text always nudges students to write differently tomorrow than they're writing today. Because if they just play it safe and never take risks, their writing doesn't change. So the mentor text helps them to take risks. Often students will fall in love with an author like a Cynthia Ryland, and that author will become a mentor author for that student. And then the student collects books by that author and hunts for the author's fingerprints, what that author does successfully over and over again. And after studying that author, some of those fingerprints then can be owned by the student.
That's beautifully said, Lynn, and you used my favorite, Cynthia Ryland, as well. Oh, I could talk about that all day, but I want to bring Robin in next, and I'm glad that you're going to stay with us, Lynn, to the end of the show where we can all have a conversation.
Absolutely.
So,
thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I'd like to now turn to you, Robin, and I'd ask you to first tell us about your background as a reader and a writer.
Sure. As I listened to Lynn, it was interesting because my background, both professionally and personally, is very similar to Lynn's. I'm a retired teacher. I taught for 35 years in Columbus Public Schools, and most of my career was involved around language arts, reading, and professional development. So I worked in our district, in addition to whatever job I was currently holding, in developing in-service training after school for teachers in both reading and writing initiatives that we implemented, and then also working on the writing teams that wrote developed the curriculum guides for both reading and writing. And then in terms of regular positions that I held at the building level, again, I was real similar. I was a reading teacher for a long time. I was a classroom teacher at one point. in fact, I ended my career as a classroom teacher, but in between, for 22 years, I was out of the classroom as a Title I reading teacher. I was a reading recovery teacher for a long time, and also a literacy coach. The bulk of my time was spent as a literacy coach working at the building level. At the district level, I was also a teacher on special assignment for the reading department at one point and also for the Title I department. Like Lynn, I came to the National Writing Project through a local affiliate. I went through the Columbus Area Writing Project Summer Institute in 2005, and I have been involved with the Writing Project, fell in love with the Writing Project ever since. And that's why I was so excited about this a radio show, because it involved Writing Project people, so I knew it was going to be something that was going to be worthwhile and fun. Currently, I am one of the co-directors of the Columbus Area Writing Project, and in that capacity, I co-facilitate the Summer Writing Institute at The Ohio State University, and then I work also with a variety of initiatives, and it depends on what year it is, what those initiatives are. Most recently, I worked with a teacher inquiry group, which worked together for about a year and a half, culminating in a presentation in 2012 at NCTE. And it's interesting. They have finished their work now, the intense work that we did, but they still wanted to stay together, and so we are now a more informal writing group rather than working on research. I also read professional literature. Some of those that have influenced my writing, of course, are the two Donalds, Donald Graves and Donald Murray, and then also Katie Wood Ray and Ralph Fletcher. Early on, Lucy Calkins, and more recently, Jeff Anderson and Kelly Gallagher, and also George Hillocks, not because he's recent in terms of the work. He does have a fairly new book, but I came to him later and discovered him later. Those who influenced me in reading include Reggie Routman, Mari Clay, Gaysu Pinnell, Stephanie Harvey, and Ann Gouvitz, Dorothy Strickland, Richard Allington, and now I'm dating myself a bit, Ken Goodman and Frank Smith. But they had a profound impact on the beginning of my career. Their work was new when I went through my master's program, so I must include them as my influences. And then I also read general books on writing that don't really have anything to do with the teaching of writing or education of writing, you know, in the public school setting. So I read Georgia Heard, and she does have school things, but she also has things that are for adults that are not really school-related. Natalie Goldberg, Bonnie Goldberg, and Jane Yolen, Stephen King, others that are just talking about writing and the craft of writing as I work to hone my own craft. And I agree with what Lynn said, that if you're going to teach writing, you have to be a writer. That doesn't mean you have to be a published writer. It doesn't mean you have to be Ernest Hemingway or Toni Morrison, but you have to write so that you understand when a student is stuck or can't think of a topic or needs to revise and is dreading that and so forth. We need to understand what we're asking our students to do. And then I'm just a reader and a writer in general. I love to do those things, and I have a passion for that and continue to enjoy, even though I'm retired from teaching in the public school, I continue to enjoy working with teachers and instilling that passion in them.
Thank you, Robin. I feel like this show is like getting invited to a party where you know three or four guests, and then they all bring all these other guests and like all of these great names of scholars and teachers and authors who I love. This show's so much fun.
We laugh in our writing project in the summer institutes. We tell people in their interviews when they are applying that one of the things they'll need to do is be prepared to spend a lot of money on books, because they're going to hear lots of suggestions of resources that they're going to be unable to live without. And, you know, I sit and hear from our teachers that are participating, new books every year. I come away having purchased so many books each day in the writing project. So I agree with you about that.
Let's talk about your book, Robin, which is fantastic as well. The title of your book, Deeper Writing, Quick Writes and Mentor Text to Illuminate New Possibilities, is intriguing. In fact, I talked to the representative at their booth in NCTE, and she said it was flying off the shelves. People were so excited by the title and the possibilities. So Why don't you start by telling us a little bit more about this idea of deeper writing?
Well, it developed in the context of my work with the writing project and work I did following the Summer Institute when I first went through the writing project. I was so excited when I left. Like Lynn, it was a transformative experience for me. And I went immediately back to my school. At that time, I was the literacy coach, I believe. And I believe I also worked with small groups of children at that time. And I started immediately, and my principal was very supportive of this. I started an after-school writing project for students, and then an after-school writing project as well for teachers, and those both continued for about 4 years. And in that context, that's when I began to experiment and play with some of the quick writes. In fact, some of the ones that actually are in the book are ones that we used first with either kids or teachers in my building. And then when I became a co-director, it kind of became my role. We each do different things, those of us that co-facilitate in the summer. And it kind of became my role to provide a writing experience or an invitation a first thing in the morning before they went off to write on their own. And so I began to think about the kinds of writing that we were getting and what was being fostered by the writing invitations I was giving, and we finally arrived at this name, deeper writing. And for me, what deeper writing is writing that challenges writers to engage in a thorough search of their memory, a critical analysis of the relationships and situations and events in which they're involved. It's really an opportunity to discover themselves and the world. So it digs beneath the surface, looking at things that may not at first be obvious, and it reveals what's in the background, that things that you may not have explored or examined. And one of the things we find is that it touches both the reader and the writer. You may not be able to remember the definition that I just gave for deeper writing, but when you hear it, you recognize it. It's that writing that makes you sit for a minute in deep silence, and we've all had that experience when we've read to our students, no matter what age, where they just sit because the writing was so rich. Or we hear that sigh where we go, oh, when we hear something. And usually that's in response to what I would call deeper writing. It's writing that gives us fresh perspectives on what's very familiar or introduces us to something that may be very new. And I apply that term. It's not just personal narrative. Sometimes we think of that kind of writing as just being personal narrative, but I think we can find it as well in expository and informational text and argumentative and academic text as well. For me, deeper writing, I think the crux of it is that it's writing that asks or invites us to ask what more, what else, why, so what, and so what for who. And I think the prompts or the quick writes in the book or the invitations or similar ones that other people would develop, not just mine, are ways to engage students and lead them to relevant, substantive, meaningful, authentic writing. And in my work with students, both in my classroom, with students I work with as a reading teacher, with the students in my after-school program, with teachers both in in-services in the public schools and in the writing project, I have come to find out or discover that the sources of our writing ideas are four. And I call them the four C's because they all do start with C's. And it's not a linear process where you have to start. I have to talk about it in a linear way. But you don't have to start with one and then move to the next one. You can start with one of, all of, or a couple of to get started for an idea. So, for example, context is what makes us want to write. Something makes us want to write. We don't write in a vacuum, particularly nonfiction. So we might have a conversation or overhear a conversation or read a book or several books in juxtaposition. We might see a piece of art or hear a piece of music or be involved in an event. All of those things might make us want to write. They don't dictate the meaning we want to make or what we want to write, but they make us want to write. And then content would be the actual meaning that we want to make or construct, that we want to discover or explore, or that we want our readers to discover and explore. And then container is the third C that I talk about. And I do mean genre by that, but I also mean more than genre. For example, I might write a poem, and then that poem might become the narration for a movie maker movie that includes images that are going to be critical to the meaning, as well as sound and meaningful transitions and music and so forth, and all of that would go together. And to me, that would be the container. And then also included in my concept of container would be the how I present it to my audience. So who is my audience and how is it presented? Am I using it? For example, if I made a movie maker movie, which I've done in the past, that may be what we use to spark writing, that just that. Or I've used that same movie, maybe a portion of it, to show my students relating to a subject we're studying in social studies. So all of that would be part of container. And then the last C for me is container lining, and that's my term for the lenses or the perspectives through which we look at everything we do, our reading, when we're reading, and the writing, and how we interact with the world. So at any given time, we're wearing all at least one lens. So people can't see me because we're on the radio, but if they could, they would see some obvious lenses that they would assume I was wearing. I'm African-American. I have short hair. I'm short. I love jewelry, so there's lots of jewelry on me always. And then we also have lenses we wear that people maybe can't see and maybe can't make assumptions about. So, for example, I'm Christian, specifically Episcopalian. I'm a wife. I'm a stepmother. I'm a Democrat. I'm a daughter, and so forth. So we all have lenses that we wear. And the reason I call it container lining is because I think about kind of a the basket that you use to put bread in, and it sits on the table in the context in the basket, which would be the container, and then there's the bread. But what separates the bread from everything else is this liner. And the liner there kind of colors how we look at the bread. So it could be a red liner, which would give us one kind of feeling. It could be lace. It could be paper and so forth. So that's kind of where I originally – that's kind of the metaphor that I use for that when I'm talking with folks about that concept.
These four C's are fascinating, Robin. I'm going to want to think about them for a long time. I have one more question for you before we move on to talk to Carla. And, of course, we don't want to tell everybody everything that's in your book. We want people to read your book and interact with these ideas in that way. But before we move on, can you talk specifically for a few minutes about mentor texts in your work with readers? I'm sorry, with writers and as a writer?
Sure. And I agree wholeheartedly with everything that Lynn has already said about the use of mentor text. But I think it's important that we, as writers, help our students have opportunities to see possibilities in what they can do. We invite students and other writers to use mentor text in that way. So when I present the invitations that are in my book, and I use lots of times ones that are, of course, not in the book, I always show up with stacks of books in order to do that. So some of the books are going to be things we're familiar with, but some are going to be based on what we're trying to do. So that if I'm inviting you to write a particular kind of poem, here are lots of options about lots of ways people have approached that. If, for example, our topic would be death, then I would bring different writers that have written in that context to show what they've done, to show you some opportunities or possibilities for your writing. For example, in the context of death, Jane Yolen, Nikki Giovanni, Mary Oliver, and more recently Maurice Sendak all wrote books related to losing someone that they loved. Now, what they wrote was all very different. It was all poetry, but it was all very different. But if I were going to write in that context, if someone close to me died and I decided I want to write something, then I might pull out those four books to look at what they did and how they did them. And when we think about mentor texts, we often say book, and they don't have to be book. I think it's probably more important that we say text, realizing that it can be anything. It can be a sentence that we're using. It can be a paragraph, or it can be a whole book. And so there's several ways that I incorporate in my classroom and working with teachers the way that we do that. One's kind of an inquiry process. And Katie Wood Ray talks about how we go to the store and shop and uses the example of a seamstress. So I don't sew. So when I go to the store, it either fits me or doesn't. It's my price or it's not. I like it or I don't. And that's the extent of my looking at something. Katie Wood Ray says that when a seamstress goes, she may sit on the floor and turn the piece of clothing inside out and look at the seams and look at how it's cut and then be able to maybe go home and use that information she's gathered to construct something on her own. So we do the same thing with text, whatever kind of text they are. The other thing we used to do in my classroom is something called, Vicki Spandell calls it sentence stalking, where we might be reading along and come across a sentence that is absolutely so wonderful that we have to stop and figure out what did the writer do to get the response that we gave to the text. Ralph Fletcher calls those golden sentences. And then when we're looking at mentor text, we can also look at a whole structure and borrow a writer's entire structure. So, for example, Amy Krauss Rosenthal has written a book called Encyclopedia of an Ordinary Life, and it's written kind of like a dictionary, and it follows the alphabet, and she has different entries that are disconnected, actually, and you could read each one individually and learn a little bit about her, but then together they form a memoir. And I have a friend, Gretchen Schrader, who has a blog called Meat Toast, and I think they're putting a link up to go to my blog, and I've referenced and given you a link to hers there, where she borrowed that structure. And so for the last maybe couple of months, she's been writing blog posts telling her memoir or memoir entries using that structure. Lots of people, and I included, have borrowed the structure of Wallace Stevens' poem, 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. At a Blackbird. And I think sometimes when we are not sure how to write the meaning we want to make, we borrow someone else's entire structure. I also think that we can look just at a specific feature, and I think Lynn talked a little bit about that. In my classroom, if I notice, for example, that we're doing pretty well with fleshing out the body of what we're writing and giving details and maybe some other things that we've worked at different times, but the beginnings aren't grabbing people, then I might have them pull out every book that we've read and kind of use an inquiry approach, maybe in pairs, to look at the leads of those books that we've read. And I would leave it up to them to determine how much is the lead. Is it one sentence? Is it a paragraph? And so forth. And then I would ask them to notice what the person has done and give it a name. So it may be that their book that they're looking at or their text has told a short story at the beginning or used a question or a quote or given some fascinating fact to get into. And so we would begin to chart that. So those become possibilities for whatever writing they're getting ready to do next. Lynn has in her book, and so does Ralph Fletcher, he's just written a second edition of his book, What a Writer Needs, and both of them have a list of possible ways to both begin and end something. And so I might, after they've listed theirs that they've discovered, suggest additional ways that they haven't named and maybe challenge them to locate those in text. And then in terms of composition and design of things, which is equally as important as content, our inquiry group that I mentioned, part of what we did was look at, as mentor texts, action research done by other teachers, and we read lots and lots and lots of research before we ever even decided what we wanted to do for our own. And we were looking at them in two ways. One, how was the research actually written up as the text and content, and then how did they actually design it and what format was included. And then more recently, in terms of digital work, I looked at lots of blogs. I'm a blog reader and have been for a long time, but I was simply enjoying the blogs. And then when I decided I wanted to write a blog, I had to then go back and read the blogs in a different way. So I would read and enjoy and then sometimes just sit and read 10 at a time to see the composition of how it was set up and you know, things that you don't even think about when you're simply reading and learning from and enjoying a blog. Decisions that you have to make to put them in. And then I would echo, I can't agree more with Lynn about the notion of using picture books and the reasons for using them. I'm a strong advocate of using picture books no matter how old you are because of the quality. And I would even recommend using certain authors. The authors I tend to favor, not always, but a lot, are those who are writing what I call across the board. So they're writing picture books, they're writing chapter books, they're writing books for adults. They may also be writing nonfiction and writing poetry. And with those authors, and one of the ones she mentioned, Cynthia Ryland, falls in that category. Jane Yolen falls in that category. They've got a variety of kinds of things that we can pull and choose from to share with people as possibilities.
Thanks, Robin. Wow, fantastic. We could clearly continue for much longer, but I want to make sure that we have time to bring Carla in, who teaches American history in Northern California. Robin, we'll also get a chance to have some final words with you at the end, right?
Right.
Thank you so much.
Oh, more than welcome.
Carla, who teaches American history in Northern California, as we shift this conversation slightly to think about secondary students as historians, Carla, tell us a little bit about yourself and your students and your work with the Northern California Writing Project, if you would.
Well, thank you, Tanya. I just have to shift gears here a little bit. I've been taking notes from Robin and Lynn, which is awesome. That's been great conversation. I teach, as you said, American history. I teach AP U.S. history and regular U.S. history, as well as American Lit, and a very small, rural, isolated high school in far northern California. It's the same high school that I graduated from. I won't tell you how long ago that was. But having that perspective of teaching where I graduated from as a high school student has really informed my teaching, because I recognize some of the challenges that students coming from such a small rural area would have going out into the world, and I wanted to help them navigate and be able to take advantage of opportunities that might come their way. I did not go to college right out of high school. I explored all kinds of opportunities and did everything from being a healthcare provider to being an executive in an international accounting firm, and I had lots of opportunities to actually be in different job situations, different career situations, both big and small, and I didn't write a lot of essays in that situation, but I did do a lot of writing, and that really has informed the way that I teach writing in my classroom and how I encourage students to understand that writing is really an important skill that they're going to need as they go out into the world, regardless of whether they're going on to college or not. I really was influenced after I participated in a summer institute at the Northern California Writing Project, and I did not become a teacher until I was about 30 years old, and I became involved with the Northern California Writing Project fairly early on in my teaching career, and thankfully that influenced me tremendously, because as a social studies teacher primarily, I was right in the middle of standardized instruction in California, this idea of having a list of standards that we're going to teach in the classroom, and you know, you teach the standard, then you move on to the next one, and so on throughout the school year. And becoming involved in the Northern California Writing Project not only exposed me to teachers of writing, it also gave me the courage to kind of step outside the boundaries and look for ways that I could incorporate writing into this standardized instruction model. So between coming to teaching later in life and kind of wanting to be able to expose my students to all of the opportunities that might present themselves during their lifetimes, and getting the exposure to the Northern California Writing Project fairly early in my career, it really shaped my teaching philosophy.
So that is a really nice overview that helps us understand what we're about to hear next, I think. Could you tell us about your approach to teaching, and particularly in your history classes?
Sure. I early on in my teaching career, I was very frustrated with the whole idea of standardized instruction. I You know, I wanted to follow the rules. I wanted to be a good teacher, and I wanted to make sure that my kids were prepared for that standardized instruction. But, you know, the study of history is more than old white guys in military battles. It is actually a map that shows us not only where we've been, but can reveal where we're going. And standardized instruction was like driving from point A to point E without any stops in between to really discover what was cool and interesting along the way. And so slowly over the first few years that I was a teacher, I would, you know, kind of drop a little bit of the standardized instruction and, you know, put in a project here and there that would allow students to really explore the idea of writing and sharing their ideas and not being so regimented in their learning. And teaching themes in U.S. history expands the possibilities and opportunities for teaching and learning to be really relevant, to be organic. It also allows for there to be recursive teaching so that students visit time periods in American history not just once before they move on to the next standard, but several times throughout the course of the year. And their knowledge becomes very layered and multifaceted, much like life is. It's also very cooperative in nature. I end up learning as much from the students as they learn from me, which is really what I want to happen in my classroom. And it's also real challenging and exciting because kids are engaged in not just what's happening in my classroom, but what's happening in the world. So it's really more reflective of the way the world really works. You know, not much happens in life where, you know, you do one thing and then you do another thing and then you do another thing, like standardized instruction. You've kind of got to be ready to think on your feet and move from one place to another place, and to be able to recognize connections that might exist between these ideas or these opportunities so that you can really capitalize on them. And so, you know, for example, big questions have always been the same in U.S. history, in our culture. For example, immigration has always been a big issue. What are we going to do with immigrants? How are we going to handle immigrants? And that has changed. The way Americans have dealt with that has changed throughout the course of the year, or the course of the years. For example, in the late 1880s, Americans were threatened by Asian immigrants, and our government came up with things like the Chinese Exclusion Act, which excluded Chinese immigrants from coming to the United States. And now I have students in my class who are immigrants from Mexico that are taking advantage of the DREAM Act that is currently, you know, supported by the Obama administration. So those kinds of big questions we get to explore in a thematic instruction of United States history.
So I got to say that would probably blow the minds of textbook writers, which makes me have to ask.
Yes.
In such a thematic classroom, what and how do students read and write?
You know, this is the best part of being of thematic instruction, and in trying to figure out how to implement this kind of thematic instruction in my classroom, I really kind of had to think about what the meaning of text is, and you know. One of the people who really influenced me to rethink this in a way is Tom Fox, who's part of the Northern California Writing Project and has done a lot of work with genres and, you know, how genres work in our society. And really, when you look at the study of history, text is really about making meaning, but it always hasn't come from words written on a page. You know, for a long time, people got ideas and were told what to think by the stained glass windows in a church or the pictures on a page. And so I really embraced the idea of expanding my definition of what text is as a way to provide people a means to think about and share ideas with others. Now, achieving this idea of sharing ideas with others and thinking about different things it doesn't necessarily, it could come in all kinds of ways, countless ways, in fact. And I encourage my students to embrace every single one of those ways, whether it's, you know, song, lyrics, music, pictures, photographs. All of that becomes text in my classroom. And so sometimes students will come in with a picture that they've taken that they want me to see, and they want me to understand what it is that they're trying to communicate in that way. But that doesn't mean that we don't write anything at all. I use television a lot because I think that's where kids are. That's what they understand. That's how they've been socialized. And so instead of writing an essay for an assessment task, I might ask them to come up with a proposal for a TV pilot for the History Channel, where they have to not only explain what happened, but paint a picture of what that might look like on a television show. So their writing covers a multitude of different genres and can be anything from a video they put together with a favorite song to lyrics that they're going to use for, you know, a melody that they already know. And I've had students actually compose music and write lyrics to share what they've learned about a particular key event or a person or a moment in history. Every unit that I have that I assign over the course of the year, students become historians for each of the units that we do, and they choose the very beginning of the unit, a key player in that period of history or that theme in history, and they research it throughout the whole course of the unit. And by doing that at the beginning of the unit, they're constantly looking for ways in which their topic, their research topic, connects with what it is that we're studying. And it engages them in a way that I couldn't achieve teaching strictly chronologically or in a linear fashion by the textbook. And that's where my learning as much from them comes in, because they bring in things that they've seen on television or read in the newspaper or in a magazine or they've seen on a YouTube video that I would never be exposed to. I would never even think to look there. And so I'm blessed with having students who bring in and provide mentor texts for me and for the rest of the class of how people are sharing ideas and thinking about thinking about history and the way that we interact with one another. So I've come to realize that mentor texts are, in fact, everywhere. I mean, they're absolutely everywhere. And the study of history has become much more relevant because we've moved beyond the textbook to real historical artifacts like songs, cartoons, photographs, advertisements. Right now, there's an advertisement on television that fits right into what we're studying in my class right now.
That's fantastic. Carla, it's sort of hard to believe, but we're running a little bit short on time. I wonder if in like 3 minutes, you could show us an example of what this actually looks like in your classroom. Maybe what's a unit or something.
Sure. Right now, I'll springboard on the idea of the advertisement that I just talked about. Our unit is called The Other America, and it allows for us to study groups in American history that have been disenfranchised in some way. And one of the things that we're studying are women's rights and the fight for women's rights. And recently, the U.S. military lifted its ban on women in combat.
Right.
So that allows me to have the opportunity to talk about, you know, popular movies like G.I. Jane or Zero Dark Thirty, and talk about the role of women and how they play a role in facilitating, you know, military objectives. But it also allows us to bring in this idea to share with kids that it is relevant, because the advertisement that I was talking about shows three women in military positions that the United States military is currently running now on television, so they're exposed to that all of the time. So the students they just wrote an assessment piece for me where they had to, like I I said they had to write a pilot for a television series to talk about women's rights and what they would use to communicate the importance of women's rights in a television series that was going to last a half hour. So their writing is very varied and comes in a multitude of different genres.
Genres that they think they might be excited to write one day out in the world.
Yeah, exactly right.
Fascinating. How exciting. I wish my daughter was in your class. We're moving to Wairika.
It really is exciting. I love coming to school every day.
Ladies, we had talked about how we were all going to have a larger conversation, but we have filled most of the hour with our descriptions of this work so far. So believe it or not, I'm to a final question, which is before we wrap up, I want to make sure to take a moment to thank you all for this wonderful conversation. But I'd like to give each of you a chance to offer a final thought to our listeners. Robin, do you have a final thought you'd like to share?
Well, I would just encourage people to, one, begin to notice what writers are doing as they read, and two, begin to notice what's going on in the world around them. And if we are giving our students time to write and helping them understand where writing is coming from, what will eventually happen is they'll begin to think about writing even when they're not, and they end up in that state that Donald Graves calls a constant state of composition. And we want everyone in that state. The other thing I would ask folks to do, they can hear all of our excitement about the National Writing Project and our local affiliates. If they're not already part of one, I would encourage them to check out their local affiliate and participate in the Summer Institute this summer. And I thank you for the opportunity to talk with the other ladies this evening, too.
Thank you, Robin. Carla, do you have a final thought for listeners?
I would just like to encourage any content area teachers out there, science, social studies, any, you know, career, technical type teachers, to consider the possibilities of mentor texts in the subject area that they're teaching. It can really enliven what they do in the classroom and make the experience for students that much richer.
Thank you, Carla. And Lynn?
I just want to echo what Carla and Robin have said, that mentor texts can be found everywhere. They're everywhere you look, and they can be as small as a sentence or as large as an entire text. But they help us because they serve teachers by standing beside us in our classrooms. So we are never really alone when we're teaching writing. We have our mentor text and our mentor authors with us. And again, I would like to thank you for being part of this wonderful experience and being part of the Writing Project and the National Writing Project Network. And again, if you're not part of the Writing Project or a Writing Project, look up, find your closest one, and hurry and join up, because it's probably the best decision you can make as a teacher to be part of this network and become a Writing Project Fellow.
You all have been so fantastic. Believe it or not, you were very quick in that last go-round, which means I think if we went quickly... One of the things I've already said that I loved about this show is how we've been awash in each other's company, but also the company of so many texts and authors. So I wonder if each of you would want to name an author or a text that stands out as a favorite.
For a professional book for me, Katie Wood Ray, Wondrous Words, changed forever the way I looked at a piece of writing. I can't read a book anymore without reading like a writer as well as reading like a reader. So that book stands out to me.
I'll go a little bit more, informal and say that I think Dan Brown does a great job of, popularizing history, which I love, because it inspires interest in kids that they wouldn't otherwise have. So pick up a Dan Brown book.
I would echo Katie Wood Ray. Wondrous Words, and I would also add Ralph Fletcher's What a Writer Needs, and it just has come out in a second edition. And I understand that one of my favorite writing gurus, Natalie Goldberg, has a new book out called, I haven't read it yet, but I have ordered it and have it on my iPad. It's called The True Secret of Writing. So I'm looking forward to reading that new resource as well.
Thank you all. As I told you at the beginning of the hour, I often get to host these radio shows, and this has really been a joyous and remarkable hour, and I thank you all for us tonight.
Thank you.
It's been great to get so many great ideas from colleagues that are involved in the Northern California Writing Project. Thank you, Robin and Lynn.
Thank you. I took notes like you did through the entire process and have learned lots.
I have my notebook out, too.
Yes, thank you so much, Tanya, for the opportunity.
Good night, everyone. Thank you so much.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.